What's going on, everybody? This is Chris, and I'm coming to you today from a back porch in Austin, Texas. Today, we have a really interesting episode for you on psychedelics, but first, I have a few announcements to make. One, this podcast is brought to you by the Warrior Soul of Goji. What is the Warrior Soul of Goji? It's your guide to living your best life. We provide tons of information on everything you can do to make your life better, through fitness, through wellness, and through better nutrition. We've got articles, we've got podcasts, we've got a new video up there every single day that teaches you something about nutrition and something about how to make your body and your mind perform better. We've also got some amazing training programs up there, as well as different types of supplements like Dynatropin, which I'm going to be talking about in a second. You can find us over at www.warriorsoulagoji.com. That's www.warriorsoulagoji.com. And like I said, you're going to find some amazing information up there about everything related to fitness, wellness, ketosis, nutrition, anything that you need to live your best life. It can be found at the Warrior Soul Agoji. This podcast is also brought to you by Dynatropin. Dynatropin is a natural human growth hormone secretagogue, and it uses patented liposomal technology that helps to stimulate your pituitary gland to release more growth hormone. It's 100% natural, 100% legal, and it's been proven in thousands of clinical cases to raise human growth hormone levels by 50% to 200%. Now, why is this important? Well, human growth hormone is responsible for so many different functions around our bodies, and it also relates to the rest of our hormonal production. Helps us to perform better, to think better, and to feel better. And with this type of technology, it really absorbs. This is not one of those bunk human growth hormone supplements that you're going to find. This was developed through years of clinical research by Dr. Mark Gordon and his team, and it's been proven in thousands of clinical cases. So if you're interested in checking out Dynatropin, come on over to warriorsoulagoji.com and click on supplements. It's under the fitness fitness menu on the Warrior Soul Agoji website. Again, Dynatropin at www.warriorsoulagoji.com. The subject matter of today's episode is both interesting and controversial. We're going to be talking about psychedelics. When we bring this subject matter up, most of the time people think of something like hippies dancing wildly at Woodstock under the influence of LSD, or they think of bad trips, or they think of people committing heinous acts under the influences of drugs that can seriously affect their brains. But more and more, we're starting to understand psychedelics not as recreational substances, but as plants and medicines that can help us to heal our psyches, and heal some of the blockages that occur in keeping us from being the people that we truly want to be. Doctors Dan Engel and Martin Polanco are both some of the top researchers in this field. They've dedicated much of their work to understanding how psychedelics can help people to overcome things like addiction and post-traumatic stress. And it really makes sense if you think about it. In this world today, we're surrounded by so much technology. Sometimes we take for granted the fact that some of the most complicated technology in the world exists in our own brains. And it doesn't come with a user's manual or an instructor guide. And many people think that plants and psychedelic medicines provide a sort of instruction guide for helping us to understand our own brains and to get through many of the blockages that hold us back. So with that, I'll bring you into episode 41 of the Warrior Soul podcast, which I was not a part of because I had to fly out here to Austin, Texas to participate in Paleo FX. But Andrew and his brother Adam did an amazing job interviewing both of these doctors and helping us to understand how psychedelics may help us to overcome our own obstacles here in this life. So with that, let's get into episode 41 of the Warrior Soul podcast. This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. And you need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason. To live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast.
Great. Hi, everybody. This is Andrew Marr with the Warrior Soul Podcast. And today, my brother, co-founder of the Warrior Angels Foundation, Adam Marr, is joining us as a host on the show. And we're bringing you Dr. Martin Polanco and Dr. Dan Engel. Gentlemen, we're so incredibly excited to have you on the show to introduce probably a new topic to our audience. And with that being said, Dr. Martin, what is your relationship with psychedelics, and what is your why for administering them clinically?
So I've been working with psychedelics for the past 16 years, and we use them in a clinical and therapeutic setting to help patients struggling from opiate addiction, depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder. I got into this line of work trying to help a family member. And I saw her go through an addiction and then come out of the addiction by using Ibogaine.
Dr. Dan, same question to you. What's your relationship with psychedelics, and what's your why for administering them clinically?
Yeah, my background is in psychiatry. Went through all the medical training, adult psychiatry, child psychiatry, forensic psychiatry. Had a practice in integrative psychiatry for a number of years, helping people come off of medications, and which was good. We were doing great work, and psychiatry is essentially the study of the mind from the medical perspective. And about 10 years ago, I was introduced to ayahuasca, and in one weekend workshop, I had about the equivalent of one decade of good psychotherapy in regards to like personal awareness. And at that point, I was just hooked. Because in my experience, there's nothing as efficient, effective, and safe when used in a good way as the medicines for helping us get straight with who we are and what we're here to do.
That's fantastic. Now, psychedelics get a bad rap sometimes. And when you look at, like, when we were growing up, the only thing that was really talked about was acid. And the conceptions and what was portrayed to us on what people that were using that, once we reached adulthood and start looking in and seeing the real science behind it, was so far from what was actually really going on. And it seems that there's almost a resurgence in these modalities. Why do you think that is, and what do you think is contributing to that resurgence? And either Dr. Dan or Dr. Martin, feel free to answer.
I think the initial resurgence was greater openness by the FDA and the DEA to allow some of this research. And this happened through the auspices of a nonprofit organization called MAPS, which is the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, and also the Hefter Research Institute, who basically pushed for approval of these initial and very important studies to prove that these substances are safe and effective when used in a good way. I think in the past few years, we've seen a resurgence because a lot of the conditions that we're seeing in the West that are not well treated by Western medical models and by psychiatry, such as addiction, end-of-life issues, and post-traumatic stress disorder, are particularly well-suited to be treated by psychedelics. We just had a conference recently, which was the largest gathering of researchers and clinicians involved with psychedelic therapy and psychedelic research, and it was definitely very exciting to see how many people are now on board and doing this work above ground and with very sound clinical practices.
Dr. Martin, what was some of the outcomes of that last meeting? And I mean, were people coming from all over the country? And how has that been different than past meetings and consortiums that you've been to in the past?
Well, I mean, definitely the international scope of the attendees was impressive, and really seeing the breadth of the research that's going on and at top-tier universities too. So there's research going on at NYU, at Johns Hopkins, at UCLA. It was very, very exciting, very impressive to see what's happening in the field right now.
And let me, if I can also just chime in on that too. Martin's bringing up a really good point, which is that MAPS is one of the lead organizations globally supporting psychedelic research. And one of the cool things that they did too, not only was it a massive gathering of the lead clinicians doing this kind of research, they also open sourced the information. So they streamlined for free all of the talks, and they're going to video bank them on their site for free globally. So they're being essentially like a poster exemplary organization that is not only promoting the information, but they're also advocating everybody be able to access this kind of information. And so that's one of the large movements behind this psychedelic renaissance, is because people really believe in these methodologies and they want people to understand their benefit.
And Dan, MAPS is able to do predominantly the majority, if not all, of their funding independently as well, right? So they're not funded by pharmaceutical companies or government subsidies. So there's no real bias that's leading to their conclusions. Is that correct?
That is correct. And it's one of the things, too, that is just another kind of great reflection of this grassroots movement. There is a huge interest in looking at the medicines for a variety of indications, like Dr. Martin mentioned, many of the areas where current psychiatry is really poor at, the medicines are really good at. And oftentimes people get into the conversation because of a personal experience or because of somebody in their immediate environment having a personal experience. So there's this like really strong depth of being an advocate and a champion and an ambassador for this kind of work, which you don't see in the general medical establishment, because allopathic medicine only has a few really like champion causes, and one of those being battlefield medicine, you know, in the OR, in the ER, triage style, crisis management. That's where allopathic medicine shines. But allopathic medicine, including psychiatry, is really weak at preventative care and long-term chronic care.
No, that's great. And I think, in doing some research for the show, I came across one of your examples and I really loved it. And it was talking about the Rwandan crisis and how we sent Western doctors over there to try and heal them. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I think it just really kind of gives a good focus on the differences in Western medicine, Eastern medicine, our cultural viewpoint within the United States and America, and how we try to approach healing, and how it can be ineffective, as given by your Rwanda example.
Yeah, it was a kind of a fascinating study into trauma recovery, how we approach it in the West versus how many indigenous cultures approach it. So with the Rwanda genocide, when the Hutus and the Tutsis were warring with one another, there was something like over 500,000 people killed in like less than a year. And most of that was not by gunfire, it was by machete. I mean, really brutal death on a large scale. And when the humanitarian aid came in, many of those were Western-trained psychologists, social workers, clinicians, and they were desiring to use a Western model with the traditional culture to resolve that trauma, And the reflection that many of the people going through that healing recovery experience, including the tribal leaders, looked at that approach from the West as being really contralateral to how they would approach it. For example, they said, you in the West, you try and isolate us in a closed environment inside and have us talk about all of the things that were horrible. This is exactly the opposite of what we would do. We would be outside in nature together, sharing the experience and celebrating life and celebrating what we have. And so it was like, okay, everything that we typically do is kind of diametrically opposed to what many cultures who are closer to nature would do. And when we also reflect that having the opportunity to come together as a healing community, celebrate what is present, yes, and be together with one another to grieve the trauma and heal it and release it and move it through. Many of the cultures there dance and drum and sing and move it through their systems, which is more of what happens in nature. If you look at gazelles or deer when they're hunted and they come into a near-death experience or a close encounter, they'll shake it through their system and then trot off. So it moves somatically through the system and out. We tend to kind of over intellectualize it and try and keep it kind of in the brain and in the psyche and only address it from the kind of the mental sphere. And then another cool thing and a follow-up, I don't think I shared in that last podcast, was when they did a retrospective study looking at the healing that had happened when the tribes kind of came together, there was this national reconciliation movement. And right now, through that national reconciliation movement, 92.5% of those that were experiencing that kind of trauma and death and had other family members and friends experience death, 92.5% had come to reconciliation and forgiveness.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a massive number to just recognize that they don't hold on to resentment largely when the trauma is moved through the collective and into the community and then out and forgiven and moved on. We tend to hold on to so much of our own suffering here in this community and in this culture and nationally. And so we can learn a lot from what are the benefits of being able to address talk therapy, but also what are the variety of different ways that we can come into grief and trauma work and actually start to resolve that. And in my experience from the West, I don't think there's another better methodology and framework for doing that kind of trauma recovery work than the psychedelic medicines.
I mean, that level of recovery is unparalleled and unprecedented. So when you transfer or transition today, looking at the Western medical model as it's applied, let's say the veteran arena or community, who people who have been exposed to things that has led to traumatic brain injury or, you know, post-traumatic stress. Dr. Martine, how would you recommend then, or how have you been able to treat that or help treat that? And what are some of the things that we've been able to learn from that? And then after that, Dr. Dan, if you could also chime in with your regards to that as well.
Sure.
So our main focus has been treating opioid addiction. The majority of our population is using heroin or, various pharmaceutical types of pain pills. So they're strung out on OxyContin, on Vicodin. And most of these patients, 70%, I would say, got into it because of a doctor's prescription. So they're not your average or your typical society assumes are typical addict. The way that we approach, treating them is we stabilize them, we assess them, we make sure that they're in a good and healthy place to detoxify, and then we utilize Iboga and Ibogaine to help them get off opioids with minimal discomfort. The main barrier to enter treatment is overcoming the withdrawal. And patients fear withdrawal more than they fear death. And this is also why they will do all sorts of, behaviors which seem crazy from the outside, like stealing or prostituting themselves or putting themselves in very risky situations. But it's just because they want to avoid withdrawal. For them, withdrawal is like having a really bad flu combined with sleeplessness and anxiety. And they know that as soon as they use a little bit of heroin, they're going to feel normal again. So what the ibogaine does, it takes away 90% of these symptoms and allows them to enter sobriety in a very easy and painless way. We then followed up 3 days later with a dose of 5-MeO-DMT, which is derived from the venom of the Sonoran Desert Toad. And this allows patients to have a mystical experience, which is a very healing and therapeutic effect on them. And we found through our research that it's the depth of the spiritual experience which predicts long-term success. So that's the majority of our work. And
Dr. Martin, can you go into a mystical experience and kind of define, because I know it's kind of, it might be misunderstood by a lot of people. So what exactly does that mean, the mystical experience, spiritual experience?
So there's different scales to measure mystical experiences that have been devised mainly by people studying theology and religious experiences. They include, you know, a sense of oneness, a sense of connection, infinite love, a feeling that that what is being experienced is more real than reality. And Dr. Dan can also add more information on that subject. He has a lot of experience with different plant medicines and how they can occasion mystical type experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Dr. Dan, what would you say?
Martin, you laid a great foundation there. When we're talking about the varieties of mystical experience, a lot of that is from the earliest writings with William James, who wrote the varieties of religious experience. And so when we release the kind of religious dogma and we get back into just the mystical sense of a spiritual connection, all of those aspects of oneness and timelessness and a sense of connection to a larger benevolent experience with the universe and whatever that person's relationship with God, Spirit, Creator is, it's that recreation with something larger than ourselves that is predictive of a healing experience because it helps us remember that it's not just about us and we're not just this kind of like isolated, orphaned microcosm walking around in the universe at a whim. We're actually part of an entire benevolent structure of living consciousness on one collective planet that we call Earth. Everything is connected. And spiritualists have been talking about this for thousands of years, and scientists are now starting to see that as well. And it's phenomenal that more and more of these science and non-duality and science and consciousness workshops and experiences are being propagated and accelerated in the self-help movement, right? If you go into the bookstore now, the area on self-help grows exponentially, like monthly, because people are recognizing that we can take responsibility, 100% responsibility of our own selves and our own experiences. And so that doesn't mean that we don't hold accountable those people. If we're going to look at it like from a veteran network, it doesn't mean that we don't hold accountable the U.S. government and the scheduling of psychedelics by the DEA. Yes, we should hold those government officials accountable for the detrimental and weakened care that they're giving our veterans at this point. And we know that psychedelics are just kind of one example, but a very good example of a very hypocritical scheduling classification that unfortunately makes it illegal for a lot of these substances to be used by veterans. And in fact, if you do, if I'm a veteran and I have like 100% service disability for something like PTSD, and I go to seek some of these treatments and I'm using something that unfortunately is Schedule 1, then that could threaten my service-connected disability. And so there's a huge hypocrisy. Most of the medicines in Schedule 1 don't even belong in Schedule 1 because there's two classifications for Schedule 1. One means There's no medical benefit. And the second is that it's highly addictive. Ibogaine's a great example of how it fails on both accounts. Ibogaine is not a recreational experience. It's a pretty horrendous experience for many people to go through. But yet the liberation on the other side, whether it be releasing from heroin addiction or any other kind of addiction, because Ibogaine's really therapeutic for many addictions besides just opiates, the liberation that comes through that experience is pretty phenomenal. So that's why people will opt into a system, even though they don't do it because it's going to be a pleasant experience. They know that it's going to be a healing experience. So fortunately, this podcast is a great example of the more forward-thinking movement and the grassroots movement that's looking towards legalization of the medicines so that they can be effectively offered in a safe container for those that are ready to have the experience.
What are those other addictions that you have seen high success rates, whether they went in intentionally to have that addiction to try and overcome that, or whether it was maybe something that they didn't even know they were addicted to and were able to come out through this treatment and see that they were, in fact, addicted, had a problem, and it was having a negative impact on their well-being?
Was that question directed to...
Well, it's just a follow-up to you, Dr. Dan, just saying that there's several different...
Yeah, there's kind of two... There's two ways to answer that question. Number one is specifically with Ibogaine. Ibogaine helps to wipe the slate clean, so to speak, neurochemically. It works on 40-something different receptor profiles. Many of those are kind of the cardinal neurotransmitter profiles that we, from psychiatry, are aware of. Serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, epinephrine, et cetera, as well as the opioid, mu and kappa opioid receptor profiles. So it kind of seems to go in and just kind of reset everything neurochemically, right? That's what's happening in the hardware. What's happening in the software or the belief systems and the attitudes also uncovers and kind of reconfigures over time. And that is where the integration work is extraordinarily important. When we're looking at success rates over time, Dr. Martine's right in that people's experience of success is proportional to their experience of a reconnective healing and reconnection with whatever their sense of like a larger purpose / spirit or God is, as well as the integration support moving forward over time. Because if somebody comes to an Ibogaine experience and they get kind of like their whiteboard is kind of reset back to zero, if they go back into their home environment and all of the triggers and all the social cues for that addiction are still there, there's a high likelihood they're going to relapse. If they have addiction recovery support and aftercare on the other side, their chances of success go up exponentially. So that's a couple of just different ways that we recognize that the experience with something like Ibogaine, we could also say the same thing is true for ayahuasca, psilocybin, MDMA. Going through a healing experience, it's important to be able to integrate that now moving forward in life.
So, yeah, so people come to us seeking mainly treatment for opioid addiction, but it's rare that they only use one drug. It's mainly polysubstance abuse, so they're, you know, combining their heroin with Xanax. They often smoke cigarettes. They drink alcohol. At some point, people become very, very well-versed in psychopharmacology, and they know what drugs to use to... fall asleep, to get energy,
okay.
You know, depending on the mind state that they're trying to achieve. When somebody comes to us looking just for help for alcoholism, I don't think Ibogaine would be the first line of treatment. So I often refer them to ayahuasca practitioners or, you know, more traditional Western models, primarily because when a person is physically addicted to alcohol, they shouldn't take Ibogaine because the withdrawal from alcohol can be deadly. And Ibogaine doesn't do anything for the physical withdrawal of alcohol dependence. The same goes for benzodiazepines. When somebody is using a large amount of benzodiazepines like Valium and Xanax, they need to taper off slowly. They can't expect Ibogaine to be the detox. because it just doesn't work, and they could have a seizure, and then that's very dangerous.
Dr. Martine, what is the difference between DMT, which seems to have a growing popularity, and then 5-MeO-DMT, and then ayahuasca? Can you kind of briefly go over those and then how those could be used in certain settings for medical benefit?
Sure. So DMT and 5-MeO-DMT, they're structurally very similar. So DMT, what's commonly known as DMT, is actually N,N-DMT, and it's found in various plants, including in the brew of ayahuasca, which itself is composed of two or more plants. The difference, I would say, is from a phenomenological perspective, like the actual felt experience is different. With N,N-DMT, it's a very visual experience. And with 5-MeO, it's more of an embodied sense of unity, connection, oneness, and love. It's often referred to as, so N,N-DMT is often referred to as the spirit molecule, and the 5-MeO is referred to as the God molecule. So it's a different experience from a felt experience, but also chemically they're different from a structural perspective.
Is it that the molecule interacts with the pineal gland, or what is the mechanism to produce these mystical states, and that oftentimes can then have these profound new understandings which otherwise would not have been able to come to?
Yeah, so the both molecules, the N,N-DMT and 5-MeO-DMT, they're already present in the spinal fluid and then the brain of most animals, including humans. So they are neurotransmitters. They serve a function in the, you know, healthy human brain. And when you flood the system with a large quantity of them, they stimulate certain receptors, which in the case of 5-MeO-DMT help you differentiate self from other. So they're receptors that allow you to tell where your body ends and the rest of the universe begins. So when you flood the system, the person loses the ability to tell that difference, and hence that experience of connection and unity and expansion that most people feel. In terms of the research that Ibogaine is, I mean, DMT is produced by the pineal gland. I'm sure Dr. Dan has a lot more information on that, as his expertise is in ayahuasca.
Yeah, it's interesting how there's so many different plants in the natural world that produce high quantities of DMT as kind of extracts, as well as animals too. So you've got ayahuasca is classically two primary plants put together. One of those plants is DMT, and the other plant has an enzyme inhibitor that prevents the breakdown of the DMT. So when you're using something like ayahuasca, it lasts for close to 6 hours in the system. If you're using something like 5-MeO-DMT from the Sonora Desert Toad, it lasts for like 15 to 20 minutes. And you can kind of conceptualize it like the entire experience of ayahuasca may be compressed from a 6 hour period into a 15 minute period. And it's strong, quick, trans-dimensional, so to speak, in that like consciousness goes back to creator. That's why it's called the spirit molecule or the God molecule. And in the return from that, there can be great recall. Like people really have a complete narrative about what happens. And people oftentimes come back from the experience not really fully knowing what happened, but having a sense of a reconnected experience of oneness. So whether it's highly remembered or not, there's still the healing narrative and the healing underneath that is present. With ayahuasca, you can also add other plants that magnify the experience. So these are like different animal and plant molecules as cousins. Psilocybin is another example of that. Psilocybin is another form of orally active DMT. It's called 4-phosphoryoxal DMT. Again, like a 4 to 6 hour experience. And there's a lot of really good research to suggest that DMT is produced predominantly when we're born, when we die, and even in between, so to speak, those two bookends in the spiritual kind of awakening experience. It's difficult to do human models because we haven't actually devised sophisticated sampling methodologies to be able to look at the live, active human brain and see exactly what are all the neurochemicals that are produced in the midst of a spiritual experience. And that kind of research is also what's gaining more and more momentum all the time.
Dr. Dan, how did these medicine, and I know that it's been documented that you suffered a very traumatic brain injury at a younger age. I'd be anxious to know, like, your thoughts on how you think these medicines have helped aid you in that recovery process, specifically as it pertains to traumatic brain injury.
Totally. Happy to talk about that, too, because it has a lot of relevance for veterans.
Yes.
Coming back from horrendous experiences with the neurological ramification of trauma being the traumatic brain injury, right? That's what's happening in the neurochemistry, the neurology, the brain tissue, hardware, as well as the software experience of the trauma itself psychologically, and that's PTSD. So you're looking at a continuum on the physical side, TBI, on the psychoemotional side, PTSD. All of it stemming from the consistent experience of being either getting your head really whacked. And in the current kind of way, so to speak, that we experience war trauma, particularly veterans on the front lines, there's a new classification of that called BNI, BIN, brain-induced neurotrauma. And it's this like really high frequency devices that are exploded, and the brain kind of ricochets at this really high frequency so that you can get actually the experience neurologically of several hundred brain traumas in a very short window. So there's a variety of different ways that the brain experiences trauma. Yes. And what happens when the healing is expressed through something like ayahuasca is that it happens to both help release the embedded trauma both physically and psychologically. The way it does it physically on the neurology side is it stimulates BDNF, which is brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or essentially that's like the growth of new neurons. So it helps to heal the contused brain at that level of focal trauma. So the scaffolding gets repaired. The neural pathways get repaired physically. Psychologically, it's the experience that Dr. Martin was kind of alluding to before when he said, like, you know, there's a part of the witness perspective of the brain that comes online and is able to, through the experience too, be separated from the fear center as well as the memory center. So if we're able to, going through that process, you're able to see the trauma happen, feel it, but not get overwhelmed by the fear to the extent that like all the survival mechanisms kick in, armor shuts down, and you can't like really get back into the felt sense of it. And then the memories of it come back online. So being able to go through that corrective experience with multiple areas of the brain now, being able to like look at this and re-experience it for a corrective experience, for a healing experience, there are very few other modalities that help that kind of perspective happen. Classically, the only two that I know of that are consistently spoken about in the literature are near-death experiences and hypnotherapy, where you're able to kind of walk back through a potential trauma, see it from multiple perspectives, and reincorporate that traumatic part of the self back into a new integrated whole. That was my experience with ayahuasca. After half a dozen severe brain traumas that we could talk about in a whole nother kind of like workshop, there was the felt sense of healing neurologically, and there was the felt sense of healing the traumas associated with each of those injuries.
Dr. Dan, how is it that emotional traumas are trapped in the body as stored energy or in the lymphatic tissue? Can you speak on that? Because that's just fascinating.
Yeah, I've had the opportunity to study with some really wise people, much wiser than myself, in the field of chiropractic medicine. And my first mentor was a chiropractor named Roger Bell. And it's appreciated through chiropractic medicine, physical-oriented medicines like osteopathic medicine, even massage therapy, that, quote-unquote, the issues are in the tissues, which means that the neurochemical substrate, the neurochemical peptides that are released through different energetic profiles, different emotional states, flood the system, responding to something in the environment, and those peptides can lodge. I can jump back on. Can you hear me well?
Yes, sir, we can.
Okay. Just to kind of recap on that, peptides are held in the system. Neuropeptides are released depending on what emotional experience is happening, what mental experience is happening, responsive to an environmental stimulus, right? So something that makes us happy, excited, moving forward, that is a whole neurochemical cascade that's different than something that's fearful, that makes us retreat, become scared, blocked off, walled off, in survival. So those neuropeptides have a myriad of effects in the system, and those peptides get lodged into the soft tissue, oftentimes in the lymphatic system, which is kind of like the circulatory system of the soft tissue. And we see it experientially, whether you're going through some kind of like myofascial release work, deep tissue massage, osteopathic or chiropractic adjustment, you can see a wave of psycho-emotional, mental, emotional release happen once that's dislodged. Same thing with the medicines and ayahuasca working to clear the system from the inside out.
Now, as far as in the process, so if a veteran has a TBI, the first place you're going to go, obviously, is some kind of ER or first trauma. Where in the process do you think that the plant-based medicine fits in? Because obviously there's some stuff that has to be taken care of first. It's not like you're going to receive the brain injury on the battlefield and be like, all right, I need some ayahuasca. I need to
totally.
Get, right?
So, yeah, great question. Funny enough, we're talking about TBI because I just wrote a book called The Concussion Repair Manual that's getting launched right now. And I had a whole chapter in the Concussion Repair Manual on psychedelic medicines, because the psychedelic medicines have a healing experience neurologically with the traumatized brain. We see that. We know that ayahuasca and ibogaine produce brain-derived neurotrophic factors. They help support new neuronal growth. Psilocybin does that too. Cannabis does that too, particularly CBD and the cannabidiols. So the medicines have a place, but you're also correct in that once there's a TBI has occurred, step one is crisis management, triage care, emergency care. That has to happen. So once the system's stabilized, then you come into the healing arts to know, you know, what else is necessary to decrease the inflammatory load, to be able to bring the system back towards homeostasis as quick as possible. There's a variety of different technologies, supplementation, kind of lifestyle management tools and techniques to utilize. And then after that, once the system is stabilized, then yes, we can move into the discussion about does it make sense to use a psychedelic medicine, and at what time does that make sense, what medicine to use, and kind of like how do we set the stage for an integrative therapeutic protocol.
Yeah, great. That was going to be my next question, like getting into the preparation stage. How do you manage, or how do you recommend managing expectations, setting intention, and then going about and actually integrating that experience into your everyday life?
Great question. Anytime we're talking about having a psychedelic medicine healing experience, we're talking about a three-phase approach, which is preparation, number one, experience, number two, integration, number three. And the preparation work for something like Ibogaine, what Dr. Martine and I have seen, if we are taking somebody who's had a 10 to 20 year history of heroin use daily on the streets, they may have like zero preparation. You know, maybe their family found Ibogaine therapy, they got in touch with Crossroads, and they sent their loved one down. So there might be very little preparation. And that doesn't mean that the experience can't still be meaningful and that the integration is not still important. So the preparation can take a variety of different styles. Ideally, there is the discussion about expectation. There is discussion about what the intentions are. Trying to, if we're using something like ayahuasca, then yes, there's usually the discussion around what's called the dieta or how to prepare the body in order to have a safe, meaningful experience. Usually when we're going through that kind of opportunity for healing, it helps to have a really deep, supported preparation process and a deep, supported integration process, just as much as the experience itself. But if we're looking at like the 30,000 foot view, I think you can make a good case that the preparation work is like 10 to 20%. The experience is like 30 to 40%. And the integration is like 50 to 60%. Because if you don't integrate it, it won't be lasting. That's a necessary piece. So coming back to kind of like your original entry point, in the preparation, it's all about releasing expectation. Making sure that the experience is going to be safe, that the people that you're working with are, they know what they're doing, they have high integrity, the medicine is clean, clear, and that the environment is conducive to that healing experience. It's not just a recreational journey. It's not just doing a trip with a friend who doesn't know how to hold the space. And there's a lot of expectations that get built in. The medicines, when we let go of expectation, we trust the experience, and we trust ourselves in the experience, they're going to do what they're going to do. Medicines give us what we need, not necessarily what we want. And so a lot of people will have a frustration if they have an expectation that something particular is going to happen, and then that doesn't happen. And so they think the whole thing was just unmeaningful. And that's kind of like one of the more unfortunate outcomes, because everybody's experience, when it's done in a safe, good way and the medicines are held well, everybody's experience is valid, and it's just another part of the healing process.
Dr. Dan, what would you recommend for a safe set and setting?
It's kind of depending on the medicine that's being used, what it's being used for, and where it's being done. Unfortunately, in the States, unless you're a part of a clinical trial, all the medicines are illegal. Yes, there's a huge underground movement. Again, this is a grassroots movement. People know the medicines work, so they're seeking them out on their own. If somebody's going down that direction, it's important to know that whoever is facilitating that work is extraordinarily experienced. I've heard just unfortunate stories of people going down to the jungle, having a week or two experience with ayahuasca, and then coming back to the States and starting to facilitate ceremony, which is incompetent, number one, and negligent, number two. So it's important to know that the space can be held well. What's that person, what's that facilitator's energy, what's their experience, and do they know how to work as a spiritual EMT, which means that the shit goes down, do they know where the ripcord is? Do they know how to safely manage a crisis situation? Just like we would do in emergency care, right? So the safest thing to do is to recommend people go outside the country for something that would be like Ibogaine. Crossroads in Mexico, I think, is one of the most sophisticated, well-run clinics for good, safe addiction treatment. For ayahuasca, the Temple of the Way of Light is just another kind of classic, very well-run, high-integrity, good medicine facility down in Peru. And unfortunately, not everybody's going to be able to afford to be able to travel internationally for this kind of work. So it's our due diligence as a medical field to do do what we can to reschedule and reclassify these medicines, offer them in a good way that's available to the masses. We know they're safe. That's why MDMA and psilocybin are going into phase 3 trials right now. They've already cleared safety profiles. Ibogaine is one of those that needs to be managed well by a medically trained, supervised clinician because of the way it affects the heart. So there are certainly medical protocols to put into place to ensure that safety. And ultimately, a person going through that experience has to take 100% responsibility to do their own homework and to like listen to podcasts like this, get as much information as possible, but still dropping the expectation and try and find well-oriented altruistic facilitators who know how to use the medicine targeting their desired outcome, right? So if it's somebody healing from TBI or PTSD, great. Then work with a facilitator who knows how to do that, that has positive experience using the medicine for those outcomes.
Dr. Martine, what have you seen? I'm trying to get some feedback. Hold on a second, guys. Dr. Martine.
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
I was getting some feedback. I was fixing that. What's your experience when somebody's brought into the Crossroads Ibogaine and they're coming kicking and screaming? In other words, they're not wanting to be there, so it's like a last-ditch effort by the family, and they haven't bought in, but they're there. Have you experienced that, and are they still able to have a beneficial outcome in that setting there?
We generally don't take those patients because if they're not ready to get clean, then there's no intervention on this planet that will get them clean. I mean, it's addiction. This is both, you know, physiology and it's a choice. So people, you know, make the decision to use or not to use. And yes, once, you know, they become physically addicted, they lose that choice. But even when we get somebody clean with Ibogaine, they're going to have to make that choice whether to use or not to use. So when I explain this to families is that this medicine is just empowering them to have choice again. And if the patient is not willing, you know, to get on the phone with us and talk to us, and we don't get the sense that they're ready, we don't even take them as patients. People are also able to back out of the experience up to any point. Like, we never force people to take this. It's completely voluntary, and people are in Mexico because they want to get clean. Sometimes we are not able to get to the root of where the decision got made, and yes, the families do pressure patients to get this treatment, either by threatening to cut off support, or, you know, there might be, you know, children involved, and they might lose custody of the children. So that it's a little bit cloudy there. And I have seen people have great experiences and they do get clean, but in general, it change comes from within. It can't be imposed from the outside.
Dr. Martine, what's the process if somebody wants to come to Crossroads?
Well, the first thing would be to talk to one of the intake coordinators to get an understanding of what the process is and what it's not, and also to see if they're good candidates. Like I mentioned earlier, if somebody is primarily using benzodiazepines or alcohol, this might not be the best route for them. If somebody has heart issues or liver problems, then Ibogaine is not a good option for them either. The next step would be for them to talk to the medical screener, who's a U.S.-trained nurse that helps to make sure that the drugs that are in the system will not interact with Ibogaine. Once all that is clear, then they come to the program. We do a drug test. We do a very thorough medical evaluation. We do an EKG. We draw blood. And we determine, you know, whether they're healthy enough to take the treatment. Then we stabilize them utilizing morphine. So instead of them, you know, continuing to use heroin, we switch them over to a legal opioid so they don't go into withdrawal and they're ready to take the treatment.
What's the success rate been, Dr. Martine, as far as sustainability of remaining sober or off opiates and opioid addiction after the treatment?
So we've done an outcome study and we measured the outcomes of 100 patients over the course of 2 to 4 years. This was done by a researcher by the name of Joseph Barsuglia, who is trained at UCLA. And what he found was that 27% of patients did not touch the drug of choice, which means that they stayed completely sober, which is really high for opioid addiction. And then there was an additional 30% that saw benefits in their use. For example, they switched from one drug to another that was not as harmful. For example, when somebody switches from heroin to cannabis, that traditionally would be considered a failure. But in my mind, if somebody is switching from heroin to smoking a lot of pot, that's harm reduction. They're not going to die from that addiction. So that would be a success. So in their own understanding, they are better, and they consider the treatment to have been successful. So it's a good 60% of people that are helped by it, but they're not all clean by traditional metrics or standards.
Sure. Dr. Dan, when you see that it's a software issue or problem, or the individual, you know, understands that it's a software issue, what would you recommend to that individual for, you know, healing, software healing, and also self-exploration?
Yeah, I come back to the summary statement. I don't know of a more effective intervention for our day and age and how the Western mind works than the psychedelic medicines for getting us up-level in our software. Essentially, like up-leveling our operating system, helping us get clear with what the trauma is, where it lies, how it got instilled, what are the default programs that we're all running. Do those come from childhood issues? Do those come from our ancestral lines? Is that part of the cultural imbalance right now? I mean, right now we are in the midst of so much innovative technology, but yet we're doing that willingly to the severe detriment of every other species on the planet. Every other species is negatively impacted by the human drive right now, as well as the system at large, as well as the planet at large. So that is also getting impregnated into the system. We are all carrying the collective consciousness, if you want to describe it as that. So it depends on what level that we're talking about of the software. Most people are entering a healing experience because they're having something from their own perspective. Depression, anxiety, addiction, PTSD, end-of-life anxiety, you know, things that are causing mental and emotional suffering. That's usually the entry point. And yet the healing that happens is oftentimes beyond just that. It's oftentimes beyond just me healing my own personal experience. It's me healing my relationships with my family, my relationship with my own self, my life, the planet itself, like recognizing that maybe I've been living in a way that was unauthentic to me, trying to meet other expectations and trying to gratify society's norms for success. So there's just so many different ways, and it's all individual. It's all unique. It's still unfathomable to me that like every snowflake is different. If you look at it like under a microscope, that's just crazy. Same thing for people. Everybody is unique. So everybody's healing experience is going to be unique. And when we go through that experience, the medicines have a way of bringing that subconscious material to the forefront so that we can examine it. We can heal what's not been healed, and then we can become more integrated as a whole self now moving forward in our life.
When administered the right way, have Dr. Dan or Dr. Martine, have you ever had a patient that's been like, that was horrible, I wish I wouldn't have done that, I'm worse off for it? Because I don't think I've ever really encountered a story like that, and I'd just be interested to hear your point of view.
I'm happy to answer that. Dr. Martine, do you want to as well?
Sure, I'll have a stab at it. So the majority of people that take Ibogaine, they are glad they took it, but they don't want to take it again. It's not a recreational experience. So, but they feel that it's beneficial and that it helps them. So, yeah, there's that. And then when it comes to the 5-MeO, it is a very powerful experience, and there are definitely people that, you know, have a rough time letting go, and that, you know, are probably never going to take it again. But even the bad or the difficult experiences can be immensely therapeutic.
But even that goes back to what Dr. Dan was talking about, right, with the preparation, expectation, and integration. And by doing that work, then oftentimes that helps, you know, offset some of those negative experiences.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I'll speak to that too, because I also want to help us remember that the medicines aren't for everyone. Right. And the times when I consulted on clients who have had a really bad outcome, it might be something where their expectations weren't met. It might be something that part of the healing has happened, but not the full healing has yet happened. So their material, so to speak, is getting brought up to the surface, and now they're having to come into contact with something that was really uncomfortable, and it has not yet reached full resolution. So it might be like, well, geez, now I got all this stuff to look at. I wish I, you know, I didn't know that was there. I wasn't expecting that all that stuff that I had put so far down, I didn't realize that was to come up, and now I've got to deal with it, and that kind of sucks. And my response is, yeah, that sucks, but, you know, let's process what that is towards healing. And when that example, when a person stays through the process and is able to get through that challenge, come to terms with what has been repressed, the vast majority of the time that comes into a very healing experience. So sometimes it's just the process. Secondarily, it's because these medicines are not for everyone. Okay, well, who are they not good for? Specifically, people that have a history of mania or psychosis. Mm-hmm. Maybe that somebody wanted to have a breakthrough experience and they didn't disclose to the facilitator that they had that history, or they had a significant family history of that happening and they were already showing some signs. So they got more ungrounded, and it was harder for them to kind of land back with a sense of a whole self. So that becomes really challenging to deal with at that point. So I tend to just play it safe and say, okay, well, contraindications to this kind of medicine work is anybody with that history. Because if you mix those experiences with the medicine work, you got to really know what you're doing. And I've seen facilitators down in the Amazon where I was studying be able to work with psychosis and mania in that space, but it takes a really high level of sophistication. So it's just much safer to not do it.
Dr. Dan, what impact do you hope to have made as far as in this realm, looking back at your life's work? What would you like to have seen changed or different than when you started?
Oh, that's a juicy question. three parts come to mind. One, right now, which is what I'm doing, for example, with you guys, which it's always a privilege and an honor to do, is to be an educator and an advocate for the medicine work, for the right use of the medicine. So essentially to bridge the medical community, specifically psychiatric medical community, with the psychedelic medicine community, with the traditional medicines that are utilized and have been utilized for hundreds, if not thousands of years for benefit in our kind of cultural and human evolution. Number two is to see that we can reschedule and reclassify these medicines into a much more appropriate level. And that's not to say I'm not a complete advocate of full legalization, because I think there's an art to using these well, and not all of them are just kind of across the board safe. So it's that's a larger conversation, but at least to be able to say, let's move them out of Schedule 1 into Schedule 2 or below to be able to have access to the people that need it the most. And number three is to be able to open up psychedelic medicine centers of awakening, which I call Satori centers. So people that are having an experience in the kind of umbrella of psychiatric suffering, depression, anxiety, addiction, PTSD, et cetera, can come into a center for healing and have a meaningful experience facilitated by trained professionals towards resolution. They have the whole compendium, preparation, experience, and integration. I think we have the ability to create those centers. It's what I'm doing with Full Spectrum Medicine, is creating essentially the prototype for what is the blueprint for the psychiatric renaissance look like. And I think we have a variety of sophisticated technologies that are synergistic and we can put into healing centers for the good of the collective.
That's extremely powerful, Dr. Dan. Dr. Martine, I'll throw that same question to you. Looking back on your life's work, what impact would you like to have seen been made?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, the same question that we asked Dr. Dan. Looking back, you know, at your life's work, what impact would you like to have seen made in this specific space with the plant medicines?
I would say that, you know, echoing Dr. Dan, I think the important thing is to reclassify and reschedule these medicines, not necessarily towards full legalization, but to a category where they're restricted to be used by professionals, but that they're allowed and that the people that need them have access to them. I would also like to create a model of care that integrates, you know, the best therapeutic aspects that we have of the Western model, along with Eastern modalities and also psychedelic therapies. Right now, what we're building at Crossroads, we have a 5-story building, and we're building out different floors to house, you know, therapeutic neurotechnologies like brain stimulation and neurofeedback, along with flotation therapy, microbiome restoration, helping patients also restore their hormone levels, and having all of these different modalities under one roof. So if I'm able to create a model that then can be replicated, I would be very happy with that.
Dr. Martine, where can people find more information on you and Crossroads and everything else you got going on right now?
So the website for Crossroads is crossroadsiagain.com, and if they want to chat with us, that's the best way to get in touch.
Okay, great. Is there anything else you'd like to say to the audience, or any other information you'd like to convey?
I'm just really grateful for what you guys are doing, and very happy to have been on this podcast with Dr. Engel.
Yeah, it's been our absolute pleasure. Dr. Dan, where can people find out about your work and how to get in touch with you?
Two URLs are probably the best, most direct route. One is fullspectrummedicine.com. That's where essentially we're talking about, you know, what is this blueprint for the psychiatric renaissance, creating these new centers for healing and health. And secondly is the book that I'm launching now, The Concussion Repair Manual. And that's at theconcussionrepairmanual.com. Actually, it's just concussionrepairmanual.com. And I, like I mentioned to you before, I pulled the chapter on psychedelics from that book because I wanted it to be more applicable to the wider audience. And we're going to bring that chapter into a future book because there is a lot of cross-pollination in the medicine work, not only being used for the software issues and the mind system, but also for the hardware in the neurological system. So that'll be forthcoming. And as Dr. Martine said, it's always a pleasure to be able to talk about this kind of work. Dr. Martine and I have shared this stage, so to speak, in a variety of different podcasts, and it's always good to be able to synergize with him and our mutual missions. And thankful for what you guys are up to. Please keep doing it. This is how the movement gets propelled past the point of biasness from the legal governmental stages. You know, you guys are helping to build the grassroots movement so that this big wave has no barriers and can really help people heal.
I couldn't agree more, Dr. Dan and Dr. Martine. We both learned about you through the podcast medium as well. And so our hope, you know, going forward is that this information is now available to a veteran or another listener that didn't previously have access to it. So it was a complete and total pleasure. Enjoyed listening to you and diving into these topics as always. So thank you very much for your time.
Yep, gentlemen, we'll end on that. This has been the Warrior Soul Podcast with Dr. Dan Engel and Dr. Martine Polanco. We'll see you next time.
All right. Take care, guys.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much.
What's going on, guys? It's Chris again, and I'm just coming back at you to let you know that the show notes for today's episode, if you want to get linked to Dr. Polanco or Dr. Engel, will be including links to them in the show notes, and that'll be at warriorsoulagoji.com. It's under podcasts, and it'll be episode number 41. Also, I wanted to remind you that a lot of the success of the show really depends on you and your reviews and letting us know exactly what you think of us and letting us know what you think about the material, letting us know what you think about the guests. We want to give you everything we can to help you to live your best life, and we want to know if we're having an influence or not. So whether you leave us a one-star or a five-star review, just head over to iTunes and leave us a review right now. Let us know how we're doing. Of course, if you leave us a five-star review, it definitely helps us out, and it helps us to get out there to more people because it increases our exposure on iTunes. Also, of course, we definitely appreciate your support if you shop at Warrior Soul Apparel or Warrior Soul Agoji. It definitely helps us to continue our mission here on this podcast, helps us to pay for the bandwidth, and helps us to get more information out there, as well as helping us to keep the lights on here at Warrior Soul Studios. So with that, we'll be back at you next week. I'll be back on with Andrew, and we are interviewing the famous science author, Gary Toms, author of Good Calories, Bad Calories, and The Case Against Sugar. That'll be a fantastic episode, and we look forward to bringing it to you very soon. Till then, get out there and live your best life. This is Chris, out.